Zen. Zest, zip, zap, and zing. Number 1. An Osho talk, given spontaneously at an outdoor meeting to an international audience of thousands of people.
The first question. Do you really think Zen is full of zest, zip, zap, and zing? Zen is not a religion. It is living life in its totality. Here now. Religions are always postponing life. They are giving you beautiful illusions about life somewhere in the future, far away, beyond death. That's a strategy to divert and distract you from the realities of life. That is pure cowardice. It is also a rationalization so that you can be consoled that if life is miserable today, there is nothing to be worried about it. Tomorrow everything is going to be well. In fact, to suffer life today is a preparation to enjoy life tomorrow. So the more you suffer, the better. There is no reason to complain, no reason to rebel, no reason to revolt. Against all those causes which are causing misery, religion protects the establishment and the vested interests. It is a very subtle strategy, so subtle that for thousands of years man has lived under its weight without ever becoming aware that what is being done to him. Karl Marx is almost right that religion is nothing but opium for the people. It keeps you drugged. It keeps you hoping, waiting, and that tomorrow never comes. And desiring, fantasizing about life after death is a sheer wastage of time, energy, and also it keeps you stupid. Life is here now. There is no other life. Life knows no past, no future. It knows only the present. Zen is of tremendous importance. It is the greatest flowering of human consciousness yet achieved. And it is one of the fundamental revolutions. It cuts the very roots of the so-called religious structure of the mind. It is not religion, it is pure religiousness. It is not religion in the sense of being Hindu, Mohammedan, Christian, Buddhist. Hence to call Zen, Zen Buddhism is wrong. It has nothing to do with Buddhism at all. It is not oriented in the past. It is not inspired by the past. It has no goal in the future either. It is living your life passionately, intensely, ecstatically, this very moment. The very idea of this very moment is shattering to the mind, because mind lives in the past and the future. And Zen is a tremendous blow to the mind. It cuts it in a single blow. It destroys it. It takes you beyond immediately. Zen is a device of sudden enlightenment. Mind wants to be slow, gradual. It wants to move carefully, cautiously, guardedly, thinking about pros and cons. Zen is a jump into the very thick and dense life. And life surrounds you, within and without. Just as a fish is in the ocean, you are in life. Don't wait for the next moment. Live it now. Zen is a challenge. A challenge, a risk, a gamble, to put everything on the stake for the moment. The religious people cannot understand it. I mean the so-called religious, and the world is full of them. There are Christians and there are Hindus, Mohammedans, Jews, Buddhists, Jainas, Christians. These people cannot understand Zen at all. Unless you get rid of all these ideologies, you will not understand what Zen is. Zen is not an ideology. It is not a philosophy. It is living in an existential way, not in an intellectual way. Zen is not concerned with words, concepts, theories, hypotheses, assumptions, beliefs. Its total concern is with the immediate reality. The reality has to be encountered without any barriers. Unless your whole mind is put aside, you cannot understand Zen. It certainly is full of zest, zip, zap and sing. James Broughton has said, Zen is another word for jest, for zip and zap and zing. If you have no appetite for life as it is and are not excited by the koan of what this here life is about, then Zen is not for you. What I am doing here is pure Zen. I am helping you to get rid of your mind. Mind has many characteristics, many aspects, and each religion has chosen one aspect of the mind and made much fuss about it, has dragged that aspect to its ultimate logical conclusion. This is something to be very deeply understood, because it is fundamental for the understanding of the Zen style of approach. Ordinarily you think somebody is a Mohammedan and somebody is a Hindu and somebody is a Jaina. That's not really true. Every human being in his unconsciousness carries all these characteristics in him. He is a Hindu, he is a Mohammedan, he is a Christian, he is a Jaina, he is a Jew, he is a Buddhist. Of course, if he is born in a Buddhist family, then the Buddhist aspect surfaces, becomes too big, too overwhelming, and other aspects of the mind are repressed, are covered up. If he is born in a Mohammedan family, another aspect of the mind becomes prominent, but others are always present there. And they go on working from your deep unconscious. So as I look, each person has all these religions in him. That's why you can find people who can create a synthesis out of all these religions. That synthesis has no value. It simply shows that they are trying to correlate all their aspects of mind. For example, every person is egoistic, but Hinduism has developed that egoism to its ultimate flowering, holier than thou. Every Hindu believes he is born to teach the whole world. He is born with a special message from God. He inherits the real religion, the true religion, Sanatan Dharma, the eternal religion. And he thinks that he is tolerant, that he is accepting, that he is not a fanatic, that he is not in any way trying to interfere with anybody's life. In fact, he is doing all these things, but in a very subtle way. Hindus are very intolerant. Even the idea that they are tolerant shows their intolerance. Why? You should think yourself to be tolerant if you are not intolerant. I have never thought that I am tolerant. Why should I think of tolerance at all? If the intolerance is not there somewhere in the unconscious, then tolerance is not needed. You are simply yourself. But this idea of holier than thou, this holy ego, is the basic characteristic of the Hindu mind. But it is not only in the Hindu mind. It permeates all the religions in different ways. The Jews think they are the chosen people of God. And the Christians think that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God, and they are His followers. And at the time, the ultimate time, the judgment day, Jesus will separate His flock, His sheep from others, and only His sheep will be saved, others will be thrown into hellfire. And the same is true about the Mohammedans, and the same is true about the Jainas, and about the Buddhists, and the Confucians, and the Taoists, and the Sikhs. Everybody has that idea somewhere. So it is nothing special to the Hindus, but they have developed it, refined it, cultivated it, made it look very beautiful. They have decorated it. The Mohammedan is basically fanatic, utterly fanatic. He has developed that aspect of the mind. Every mind is fanatic. If you are living in the mind, you cannot go beyond fanaticism. But the Mohammedan has developed it to its highest peak. His religion is the latest arrival on the earth. Muhammad is the last prophet. Now there is not going to be any other prophet. God has sent the last edition of His message. There have been other messages before, but they are all cancelled. The last message has come. And it is so absolutely correct that there is no need for any other prophet to arrive on the earth again. This is pure fanaticism. But this is present in everybody. I used to live with one of my professors. Just a winter morning like this, I was sitting in his garden, reading a book. His old mother came out, very old, 80 years old, and she said, "What are you reading?" Just to annoy her, I said, "The Quran." that 80-year-old woman suddenly snapped away the book from my hand, threw it outside the garden. Suddenly she became so young. It was beautiful to see her back in her youth. She was so ferocious. She said, "Don't bring Quran in my house. We are pure Brahmins. And if you want to read, can't you read Bhagavad Gita? Can't you read the Vedas? We have thousands of scriptures. Why read Quran? Never bring again that book inside my house." His son, my professor, ran from his room, came out there, "What is happening?" And I told to my professor that your mother is a Mohammedan. The mother looked at me, she said, "What do you mean? I and a Mohammedan?" I said, "Yes, because this is the characteristic of a Mohammedan, this fanaticism. And you are a fool too, because that was Bhagavad Gita." She rushed out. Bowed down to the book. Cleaned the book, brought it back and gave it to me and said, "What kind of joke is this?" Trembling, shaken, I said, "This is Quran. And you have bowed down to Quran." This fanatic mind is there. Khalif Umar reached Alexandria, and Alexandria had the greatest library in the world. It is said that it contained tremendous treasures of all the ancient civilizations which have disappeared, the Assyrian, the Babylonian, and even civilizations which have totally disappeared, even their names have disappeared. It had all the scriptures belonging to the continent of Atlantis, which has gone down into the ocean. The whole continent has disappeared. Now it is Atlantic Ocean. Once it was a great continent, one of the greatest civilizations flourished there. Alexandria has never been surpassed as far as ancient scriptures are concerned. Umar reached with a torch in his hand, burning torch in one hand and Quran in another hand. And he said to the chief librarian that, "I have to ask you two questions. First, is there anything more in this library, more than the Quran?" And before the librarian could have answered, he himself said, "If there is more, then I am going to burn this library, because Quran is enough. Anything more than that is not needed. If it was needed in the first place, it would have been in Quran itself. So I am going to burn it. And second question, is in this whole library nothing but that which is written in Quran itself?" And again, before the librarian could answer, he answered himself. He said, "If you say that this library simply repeats the Quran in different ways, then too I am going to burn it because it is not needed. Quran is enough. Either way, I am going to burn it. This is fanaticism. And he burned it. The library was so huge that it is said that it took 6 months for the library to be completely burned. The fire continued for 6 months to consume the library. Compared to the library of Alexandria, British Museum is nothing. Or the library of Moscow is nothing. They are the biggest libraries now. If the library of Moscow is spread around the earth, books are arranged in a row, one book followed by another book, just like on a shelf, all the books of the Moscow library will go 3 times around the earth. But this is nothing compared to the library of Alexandria. And British Museum has even more books. They will take 7 rounds around the earth. But it is said that even both the libraries together are not comparable to the library of Alexandria. It contains all past, the whole past. Now we know only 2,000 years history. It contained at least 100,000 years history backwards. It was of immense value, but a fanatic burned it. Mohammedanism has developed one characteristic of the mind. Each mind is fanatic. You want that you are right and the other is wrong. You are always right and the other is always wrong. It is not the question what you are right about. Because it is you who believe in it, it has to be right. The fanatic is not logical, he is illogical. The fanatic is not ready to understand. He is a believer and his belief is absolute. He is not open, he is closed. And this is the characteristic of all the minds. The Jaina is a sadomasochist. And every mind is a sadomasochist. One enjoys torturing the body because mind feels powerful. When you torture your body, you enjoy that torture because your mind starts thinking, now I am the master and the body is the slave. That's what Jainism has been teaching. Master your body. If the body asks for food, don't give it to the body. You are the master. You have to assert your mastery. So fasting became one of the most significant things in Jainism. And the people who can fast for many days are thought to be great saints. They are simply torturing their body. They are mentally ill. When the body needs food, the food has to be given to the body. The body is a temple. It has to be loved, respected. But Jainism has developed that characteristic to its omega point. exists in everybody. You also enjoy torturing your body in many ways. And you feel good when you succeed in torturing. When you can force your body like a slave, like a machine, certainly the idea of power arises in you, that I am powerful. When you cannot force, you feel very dull. For example, if you want to leave smoking, it may be harmful to smoke, but you are enjoying it. It must be helping you in some way. It may be relaxing you in some way. It may be taking away your mind from your constant occupations, your worries, your anxieties. People smoke only when they are very tense. When they are not tense, they don't tend to smoke. When they are tense, they smoke. If you don't smoke, your tension goes on accumulating, which is far more dangerous than smoking. Smoking is just stupid, not dangerous. Maybe you will live 1 or 2 years less, so what? What you are going to do? Even if you live 2-3 years more, if you have not done in 70 years anything, what you are hoping to do for those 2 years plus? You will go on doing the same nonsense. You will be living the same misery, so that is not the point. Whether you are healthy or unhealthy, a little bit unhealthy does not matter much. In fact, it may prevent you from doing nuisance. Just think, if Adolf Hitler was a cripple or had amoebas, or was continuously having hepatitis, the world would have been saved. In fact, Adolf Hitler was against smoking, against alcohol. He was a pure vegetarian like Mahatma Gandhi. In fact, both the men have many things in common. Both believed going early to bed, and both believed in getting up early in the morning. Both believed that vegetarian food is great. Both believed that smoking is bad, alcohol is bad. Both were great saints. The only difference was Mahatma Gandhi had the jnana characteristic very much developed in him. He was only 10% Hindu, 90% jnana. So he tortured himself. Adolf Hitler had the Mohammedan characteristic developed in him. He tortured others, he didn't torture himself. But both tortured. Whom they tortured is not of that much significance. They both were enjoying torture. Adolf Hitler had been a great blessing to the world if he had smoked. He would have less tense if he had been an alcoholic. I don't think there would have been the Second World War. If he had been a playboy, things would have been far better in the world. But he was very puritanistic, moralistic. So I don't see that there is much harm in smoking or drinking a little bit of alcohol. Alcohol is vegetarian. Smoking is also vegetarian. Tobacco is not anything non-vegetarian. It is vegetarian. And just taking the smoke in and out is only a way of pranayama. Doing a little bit of exercise, breathing exercise, harmful to you, but not to make much fuss about it. But people try to control it. If they succeed, they become egoistic, which is far more dangerous. If they fail, they feel guilty. They feel depressed, which is far more dangerous. If they fail, they become condemnatory towards themselves. They lose respect for themselves. And the moment you lose respect for yourself, remember, you are losing your trust in life. You will be living now just at the minimum. Your life will not have the dance. It will not have the quality of celebration. It will be only a dragging. But this sadomasochist idea exists in everybody. Jainism has only reformed it, developed it, idealized it, philosophized it, argued about it. It is only one of the aspects of the mind. The Buddhist has developed another aspect of the mind, the escapist. Avoid, escape. Go to the mountains, go to the forest. Renounce life. That too is in everybody, more or less. It depends what kind of conditioning has been imposed upon you. These are all aspects of the mind. You can develop any aspect, but it remains of the mind. It is not spiritual at all. Zen is a transcendence of the mind. It does not develop any aspect of the mind. It takes you beyond the mind. And the only way to go beyond the mind is to enter into life here and now. You are not to be sadomasochist. You are not to be escapist. You are not to be a fanatic. You are not to be a phony, a holier-than-thou, an egoist. You have just to be ordinary, utterly ordinary, in tune with life, harmonious with life. Yes, I agree with James Broughton. Zen is another word for zest. Living life passionately. Making life a joy. A festival. a feasting, a love, a laughter. Yes, he is right for zip and zap and zing. If you have no appetite for life as it is, and are not excited by the koan of what this here life is about, then Zen is not for you. Then I am also not for you. If you are trying to attain something in the other world, that Zen is not for you and I am not for you. If you are trying to reach to heaven, sacrificing this life, renouncing this life, condemning this life, then Zen is not for you and I am not for you. This is the reason why almost all the religions will be opposed to me, will be against me. Because I will be destroying the mind, and they have all developed one aspect of the mind. They will all agree, at least on one point, in opposing me. And they are all agreed. They never agree on anything else, but they always agree whenever there is a person who loves life totally, intensely, without anything holding back. All these priests are suddenly joined together because they can see the point that their whole business is in danger. Their whole trade secret is being made open. Their whole trade secret is to develop one part of your mind and to create an unbalance in you. It is like somebody's head becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and the whole body starts shrinking. Now that man will be a monster. Life needs to be balanced. It needs a rhythm. And all these religions have created monsters, not human beings. But they have created beautiful facades, masks for the monsters to hide behind. And they have been in existence for thousands of years. Hence their conditioning has gone very deep in you. So deep that it has become part of your bloodstream, your bones, your very marrow. It is a difficult task for a person like me even to make you understand what I want to do, because all your conditioning will stand between me and you. Unless you are really intelligent and courageous, it is impossible to have a communion with me. You need courage. Courage to go into the unknown, into the unfamiliar, into the uncharted. And you need intelligence, tremendous intelligence, to see the point. The whole society tries to make you mediocre because the society is always afraid of intelligent people. Intelligent people like Socrates are dangerous to the society. Dangerous because intelligence is always rebellious. It will rebel against any kind of slavery. It will rebel against anything that is wrong. Intelligence is always for freedom, individuality, authenticity. It will fight all that is phony and pseudo. Socrates was given the alternative by the court that if he leaves Athens and promises never to come back to Athens, then they can allow him to go and he will not be sentenced to death. He refused. The judge asked, "Why? Don't you want to save your life?" He said, "The same thing will happen wherever I go. I will have to go through the same process because I will be doing the same thing there, and sooner or later they will sentence me to death. So what is the point? And in this old age, going to another place and starting from the scratch, it is better to die here and die a noble death. I will not compromise. Life and death are not so important as my respect for truth." The magistrate felt sorry, must have been a compassionate man. But because the whole respectable citizens of the Athens were against, the majority were against this man, he had to punish him. He gave him another alternative. He said, "Then you can live in Athens. I can see you are old and now going and living in some other place will be difficult for you. You can live in Athens, but promise me that you will stop talking about truth." He said, "That is impossible. Then what is the point of living at all if I cannot even talk about truth? Not only I will talk about truth, I will live truth. I cannot do anything else. Once you know the truth, you have to say it, you have to live it, because you are it. Knowing it, one becomes it." That's what the Upanishads say. Knowing it, one becomes it. Socrates said, "You don't be worried about me. You just do your duty and let me do my work. If I am alive, then I have to sing my song. And I cannot dance to anybody else's tune. I will create my own music and I will live my own life. And whatsoever the price I have to pay for it, I am ready. Even if life has to be taken away, it's perfectly okay. I am happy about it. In fact, tremendously joyous, because I can feel great respect for myself. I am dying a noble death for truth. Truth is a higher value than life itself. A life without truth is not life. It is vegetating." Socrates was given poison, and that has been happening to all intelligent people around the world. The society wants mediocre people, stupid people, unintelligent people. It starts crippling every child. Every child is born to be a Socrates. Every child brings the capacity of tremendous intelligence, but the society does not wait even a single moment it starts destroying the potential of the child. In Japan, they have a certain art form. I cannot call it art because it is pure murder, but they call it art form. It is called bonsai. In Japan, there are 400, 500 years old trees, and their length is only 6 inches. They call it a great art. They put the trees into pots without bottoms, and they go on cutting their roots. So the tree goes on becoming old, but it does not grow. It becomes very old but remains pygmy. A tree that would have whispered with the clouds, communicated with the stars, danced in the sun, in the wind, in the rain, remains just 6 inches. You can see its oldness. It is written all over it. You can see its branches are very old. You can see old age all over it. But it has been crippled by cutting its roots. It has not been allowed to achieve its potential. Bonsai is being practiced on every child around the world. So no child reaches to the ultimate peak of awakening, to pure intelligence, to pure consciousness. Because we go on cutting the roots. There are subtle ways. Before the child starts asking questions, we start giving him answers. Even before he had asked the question, we go on stuffing him with answers. All borrowed, all ugly. Borrowed means ugly. Howsoever beautiful the words may be, but if they are borrowed, they are ugly. If they are borrowed, they are not true. Truth has to be discovered by oneself. It cannot be given by anybody else. It is not transferable. But parents, priests go on forcing beliefs on the child. He becomes a Hindu, a Mohammedan, a Christian, a Jew, but he misses becoming a human being. And he becomes unintelligent because he is told to imitate. Become like a Buddha. That's what Buddhism is. Become like a Buddha. Why? Why anybody should become like a Buddha? One Buddha is enough. One Buddha is beautiful. But filling the whole world with Buddhas will make it monotonous, boring. Just think of a world where everybody is a Buddha sitting under a tree meditating. Even trees will become bored. And life will disappear from this planet. Immediately life will disappear. Or just think, all the people have become Jesus Christ, everybody carrying his cross on his shoulders. Then the problem will arise, who will make the crosses? And why go on carrying it? Who is going to crucify you? They are carrying their crosses. That's what Christianity is, carrying your cross. It is Christianity, it is not Christianity. Each child is told to imitate. No child is told to be himself. He is told to be somebody else. Just think, if you start teaching the roses to be marigolds, and the marigolds to be lotuses, and the lotuses to be roses. Fortunately, they don't understand your language. Fortunately, they won't bother about you. You can go on lecturing and they will go on swaying in the wind. They won't listen at all. But just think, if some way can be found. And now scientists are trying to find ways, and they say, yes, there is a possibility that some communication can happen between the trees and man, because trees have their own intelligence. Just we have to learn their language, and we have to translate our language. Sooner or later, devices will be available which can translate. You feed the device, you tell the rose, become the marigold, and the device will transmit into sensations, vibes, your language. And immediately you will destroy the intelligence of the rose. Because once the idea gets into the rose that he has to become marigold, the rose is finished. Because he cannot become a marigold, that is not inbuilt in his program. And his effort will be to be a marigold. And he will look with greedy eyes, all the marigolds flowering all around, and he will become disrespectful about himself, condemnatory, that I am not a marigold. Why I am not a marigold? And he will start trying in every possible to become a marigold. Only one thing will happen, he will not be able to grow roses. In all this worry, in all this frustration, depression, he will lose juice. He will lose the zest, the zap, the zinc. He will lose everything. He will never become a marigold. Only one thing is possible, he will not become a rose either. He will be without flowers. That's why millions of people in the world are without flowers, without intelligence, without freedom, without individuality. They have all been told to become like Ramas, like Krishnas, like Buddhas, like Mahaviras, like Christ, like Muhammads. That's what all these religions are. It is perfectly beautiful that somebody was a Buddha, and somebody was a Confucius, and somebody was a Zarathustra, but there is no need to imitate. Imitation is a way of crippling people, paralyzing people, cutting their roots. And each child is told to repeat the beliefs of the parents. And of course, if his mind is programmed to repeat the beliefs, he will repeat. From the KG to the university, that's what we are doing. We call it education. It is not education at all. It is just the opposite of education. The very word education means drawing something out that is inside the person, bringing his center to the surface, to the circumference, bringing his being in a form of manifestation. It is latent, unmanifest. It is dormant, making it active, dynamic. That's what education is. But this is not happening in the name of education. In the name of education, just the opposite is happening. They are stuffing everybody with ideas. Nothing is being drawn out of the well. Not the waters of the well are being drawn. Instead, rocks are being thrown in the well. Soon the waters will disappear. The well will be full of rocks. And that's what you call your scholars, pundits, your professors. They are nothing but stuffed tomatoes, stuffed potatoes, nothing else, just stuffed people, stuffed with all kind of bullshit. As three professors were sitting restlessly in the hospital waiting room, a nurse rushed in and said to one of them, "Good news, your wife just had twins." "What a coincidence," the professor shouted. "I am a ball player. I am with the Minnesota Twins." A few minutes later, she returned and said to the other professor, "Ma, what good news we are having today. Your wife just gave birth to triplets." "Now, there is a coincidence," the professor said. "I work for the 3M company." Just then the third professor fainted. The nurse called an intern and together they worked to revive the professor. As a matter of routine, they checked his wallet for identification. It was then that they discovered that he was a salesman for 7-Up. All these PhDs and D-Lits are just stuffed tomatoes. But the whole education is doing that, making people parrots, giving them stupid ideas. The son of an intellectual comes to his father and asks, "Daddy, what is dialectics?" The father, not wanting to leave his son without an answer, says, "Listen to the following, son. Let us suppose that two men come into a restaurant, one with dirty hands and the other with clean hands. Which one is going to go and clean his hands?" "The one with the dirty hands, of course, Daddy." "Very good," says the father. "Now let us suppose that the two men walk into a restaurant, one with dirty hands and the other with clean hands. Which one is going to go and wash his hands?" "The one with the dirty hands, Dad, I just told you." "No, not this time, son. The one who will go and wash his hands is the one who already has clean hands, because he is in the habit of cleaning them. The one with dirty hands is in the habit of keeping his hands dirty." "What a mess, Daddy." "That's it, son. Now you are beginning to understand dialectics." A young professor had been invited to address a poultry convention. "The first thing you must do," he said, "to properly raise a flock is to separate the male chicks from the female chicks." After he finished, a lady inquired, "Professor, how can you tell male chicks from female chicks?" "Well," he said, "you go out into your yard and dig a pail full of worms. Then you set them before the chicks, and the male chicks will eat the male worms, and the female chicks will eat the female worms." "Yes, but Professor, how do you tell a male worm from a female worm?" "Madam," came the answer, "I am a poultry expert, not a worm expert." This stuffed knowledge does not make people wise. It simply hides their ignorance. This is not education. It simply represses their ignorance. Real education will be helping the child to be more intelligent. But even the teachers and the professors don't like the intelligent children because they create trouble. They ask questions which are embarrassing. They ask questions for which the professors don't have answers. And they are not courageous enough to say that I don't know the answer. And that is a sure sign of an ignorant man who has not the courage to say that I don't know the answer. Everybody tries to pretend that he is omniscient, that he knows all that is worth knowing. So it is also in their favor to keep people unintelligent. Sean Mayer came into the garage, walked up to the parking place, and skirting down, went through the motions of driving a car. Horan said, a shocked customer, "Why don't you tell the man he has not a car? Is it mad you take me far? Sure, he pays me a pound to wash it every time he comes in." When there is a vested interest, when the person is getting 1 pound to wash a car which is not there at all, why he should tell it? It will be against his own interest. The professors, the teachers, the priests are all joined together in a conspiracy against the poor child. And of course, these people are powerful. They can destroy the child. They can program the child in such a way that he will remain unintelligent his whole life. Zen is not for unintelligent people. You have to put all the programming that has been done upon you aside, and you are capable of doing it. Just you need guts. You have to rebel. If you want to live really, you have to rebel. You have to rebel against all kind of superstitions, against all kind of stupidities. You have to rebel against your parents, against your society, against your church. Unless you do that, you will not know anything of what ecstasy this life contains. This life is tremendously beautiful, but only those who live it can know it. There is no other way. You ask me, Bhagwan, do you really think Zen is full of zest, zip, zap and zing? It is only that, nothing else. Zen is not a religion, drop that idea. Zen is not a church, drop that idea. Zen is a totally different approach. It is a life. It is synonymous with life. It is living life with such intensity that your ego disappears in it, is burnt out, that you dissolve into life, that you are consumed by the fire of life, and then only you know what a beautiful existence has been given to you as a gift. It is a sheer joy then, each moment. Each moment then it is paradise. Paradise is now or never. The second question. I am really concerned about the public kissing, hugging and touching that your beautiful sannyasins resort to at the most appropriate moments, but at rather inappropriate places. It only invites the repressed public wrath that engenders the safety of the sannyasins when it could be avoided. I feel it is high time a restraint is called for from doing this in public places, and who better to instruct or make recommendations to your sannyasins than you yourself? Otherwise, they have no business to crib and complain about public reaction. They should face the expected reaction with a smile and without complaint. Even the est trainers and their staff in Bombay don't do this in public, as it amounts to breaking agreements with Indian society, and any broken agreement has disagreeable consequences. I know all about those est holes. Werner Erhard has been here. I have seen his phoniness. He is a businessman. He is really a Jew. And I don't mean metaphorically. He is a born Jew. But it was against his business, so he changed his name. He changed his name so it looks German, Werner Erhard. A Jew is hiding behind a German name. He is not interested in you. Est is just a game. So of course, as trainers and their staff in Bombay don't do this in public. They have changed completely their program. They have made a special program for India. According to Indian tradition, culture, civilization, they do something totally different in California. This is a special dish made for Indian fools. If an Indian goes and participates in a Californian est training program, then he will know it is a totally different thing. What is being given to you in Bombay and Delhi has been especially made for you, because he has to do business. He is not concerned about your enlightenment. And who has ever heard any asshole becoming enlightened? The day assholes start becoming enlightened, enlightenment will not be worth having. Of course, he has an agreement with the society. If you want to do business with the society, you have to make agreements, contracts. I have no agreement with any society, Indian or non-Indian. I am in disagreement with all the societies. So let it be absolutely clear for you. once for all that I am not worried about any disagreeable consequences. And don't advise me that if disagreeable consequences happen, then your sannyasins have no business to crib and complain about public reaction. They have every business to crib and complain about public reaction. We are going to fight it. I am not an escapist. Even if we die in the fight, that's perfectly okay. But we will live in our own way, with no compromise at all. To compromise with the foolish, to compromise with the repressed, is to lose self-respect. And why you should be worried? You are not a sannyasin. And even if you want to become a sannyasin, I am not going to give you sannyas. This is an agreement and I will not break it. I don't want cowards. You are cowardly. And Werner Erhard is cowardly. Agreeing with the society is cowardliness. And he is an escapist. He escaped from his wife and children, from his parents, and remained for many years hidden behind a false name. He was selling encyclopedias. And that's where he learned his whole business. How to sell encyclopedias. By and by, reading the encyclopedias, he must have become very wise. And then he started selling wisdom itself. But he remains a salesman. Nothing more than that. He is still selling encyclopedias for children. And of course, he knows. So first he came to India to study, went around, met many people to see what will be appropriate for the Indian fools. And then he had made a program for them. They are very happy. And there is no commitment. You just participate in the weekend and finished. You have become est graduate. You have simply become est whole. To be with me is a commitment. It is dangerous. And I am not going to tell to my sannyasins what they should do and what they should not do. It is up to them. My sannyasins have absolute freedom. I am not going to program them for any act. If they feel it right, then it is only for them to decide where to kiss and not to kiss, where to hug and not to hug. It is absolutely their individual freedom. And the people who react are wrong. Because they are not hugging them. They are not kissing them. Who they are? Why it hurts them? Some repressed sexuality. Some ugly monsters inside them start raising their heads. A great desire to curtail other people's freedom. A great desire to dominate other people's character. India has always been a non-democratic country. It has never tasted democracy. The political democracy that we have imported from the West for these 33 years is not working at all. It cannot work for the simple reason because Indians don't have the democratic mind. Their basic attitude is undemocratic. So democracy is an imported idea. It does not fit with them. They are always looking at each other, what you are doing, what you are not doing. Now, if Maya Sannyasins interfere with their life, then certainly that is wrong, but they are not interfering at all. They are living their life. If two persons are kissing, they are not interfering in your life at all. Unless you have some repressed desire to kiss, and you have not allowed yourself to kiss your beloved, and then jealousy arises, and your sexuality starts arising in you, and you have to repress it. Rather than repressing it, you become angry at the person who made you aware of your repressed sexuality. No, Maya Sannyasins are not going to accept it with a smile and without complaint. We are going to fight it out. Whatsoever is ugly has to be destroyed, and whatsoever is repressive is ugly. The last question. Tonight I am flying to Paris, taking with me this beautiful name that you gave me for the new center, Pradeep, a lamp. Could you give me some help to screw this lamp into the French mind? And also tell us a joke with a few words in French to make Paris laugh. As far as screwing this lamp into the French mind is concerned, there will be no difficulty at all. French minds are just like sockets. You can screw any kind of bulb. There will be no problem at all. It is difficult to screw a bulb in an Indian mind, but in a French mind, any way you do, it will turn out right. And take this joke with you. A French father caught his 10-year-old son smoking. Trying to be an open-minded parent, he said carefully, "Morpheus, I am educating you with great liberty. I'll let you have whatever you want so that it does not create any complexes in you. Alors, s'il te plaît, take heed of my advice. I think you are too young to start smoking." "Jean, mon oeil," replied the son indignantly. "Why? Just the other day I fucked 3 girls." "Ah, la la. And you think I am not big enough to smoke? Ah, mon Dieu. Tough is, sir. And with what type of girls?" "Janis Shepa," replied the boy. "I was too drunk to take notice." Enough for today.